Colonel Kidson, Montgomery, Reel 5. Colonel, you were saying about taking part in exercises on Salisbury Plain. Do you remember much about what you were assigned? Your
No, I think it was mostly as a reconnaissance role. And they were mostly squadron and regimental exercises that we did on Salisbury Plain. And the big manoeuvres took part all over England.
What kind of things were you doing on Salisbury Plain?
Oh, just the same sort of troop squadron and regimental exercises.
Were you in the same kind of armoured cars?
No, we had Lanchesters. They were much bigger. And I never liked them so quite so much as the Royals. I don't think it would have been not much good, I don't think, at the desert. They were too heavy. But they were quite, you've got plenty of room in them. You had more room in them, which is a good thing, from the wireless side and that sort of thing, than you had in the Royals, which was very cramped.
What sort of mechanical problems did you meet with them? Do you remember?
I can't honestly remember. Nothing. I can't remember. There was one snag, and I can't remember whether it was a clutch or something, but I honestly, not. I can't remember what the particular one was, but they worked, but they were very big, rather big and clumsy. Certainly for these roads and round here where we had to do map reading exercises, of course, a lot of that. And I should have hated to met one in the middle of the road because it required a lot of backing in the lanes and things.
Did you, in fact, come across the manuals for mechanical warfare at this time when you come back to England, like things like the Purple Primer?
Sorry?
The Purple Primer. Had you come across the doctrinal manuals for mechanical warfare?
No, not in particular, I don't think, but I mean, we had a lot of what we used to call bump, which used to be thrown around. But, no, it was the doctrine of mechanical warfare was produced from above, and we had to, our colonel probably produced it or whatever it was, and we acted on it.
Did you at this time take part in any exercises with other tank outfits?
I can't remember, quite honestly. I expect so, but we're bound to have done on the big manoeuvres. But the chief tanks in theirs were was this brigade out in Egypt. They were mostly out there. They removed them from England, but we obviously had one or two tank battalions then. And as you see, they didn't increase them until I went to Germany, really. And it was then that that they became, there were a lot of them.
Did you find at this period, when the new recruits were coming in, were they more mechanically minded than what you had been?
I wouldn't say so. One had to develop it. I think possibly the whole nation was becoming more mechanically minded. As people had cars, as more people had cars, you got more people mechanically minded. That's all I would say. I mean, it always amazed me that, and I'm not sort of saying this myself, that my generation, about my generation, were the only people who could drive cars. You got the old and bold, the generals, brigadiers beginning of the war, who'd been on horses and been driving flies and goodness knows what. And they were, on most cases, I remember my old commanding officers were not very good in cars. And I'm not saying people like General Kerry, he could drive a car, and so could General Lumsden. But I can imagine that, I think Colonel Blackerton Houston was not very good. And I remember Colonel Charrington, he used to drive like a lunatic, and used to terrify me. But there's what I call the mechanical age was beginning then.
Did you find a shortage of equipment when you came back to England? Were you short of stuff?
No, well, we had this wireless trouble, which I think I may have told you about. I think I told you previously about that. No, that was the only thing. No, I can't remember except for that. But then again, I probably wasn't in a position as a second-in-command of a squadron to know what the troubles were. But having very good commanding officers, we seemed to get it. Whether it was the right equipment, but I could tell you much more about that, about our war equipment, which I will later on, which I got very strong views on.
When you went to the yeomanry, what were you assigned? What was your job?
I was adjutant. And I was the only regular officer. In fact, one had to plan everything. I mean, you had to do all the schemes. You had to administer the whole thing. It wasn't supposed to be hard work, but I must admit that I may have come at the wrong time, because when I arrived, we were an armoured car company, and within 6 months, you know, one had to learn one's job, and so one worked pretty hard, and then thought, oh, you're going to get a good bit of leave and that sort of thing. My goodness, next thing happened, we were made into a regiment. Well, of course, that took time as the only administrative officer. And then after that, we were then put up to war strength the following year. And the following year after that, we had to form another regiment. But I used to get my hunting and quite a lot of leave, and I worked it out. I used to go there 4 days a week. And I used to start at 10 in the morning and finish at 12 at night. So I did 2 days' work in one, so I could get away back at home and go out and enjoy myself. Occasional weekends one had two. Nowadays, the yeomanry adjutant has nothing but weekends, I think. In those days, one didn't. One had about 5 or 6 weekends, half a dozen weekends a year or more, of which one had the regiment, because that's the time one can get them together. Then one had your annual camp, and one had to organise that. But it was very...
You must be exhausted.
You had an annual camp, did you, for going with the...
Yeah, always, yes. Every year, yearly.
Where was that?
Well, it was a Popham... once, or was it twice at Popham? The one I remember was at Popham, just down here. And we were armoured cars, and Colonel Lumsden was Colonel of 12, and he sent me all sorts of assistants. I had couple of officers and 3 or 4 NCOs who came over and helped us over the camp, which was a great help. And I can't remember which the other camp. I had 2 camps. I can't remember the other one. But... that was a big do, annual camp.
And what were you doing? Were you with other
armies? Oh, training.
Training.
Yes, all tactical training. We had 2 exercises, probably the first week, and squadron exercise, and then eventually a regimental scheme, or possibly 2 regimental schemes at the end. That was a sort of setup. And then for field firing, we used to go down to all the shot. And that was generally done at Whitsun or Easter, something like that, a long weekend.
But for the actual tactical training, what were they actually being trained in?
In the armoured car row.
Yeah.
The complete armoured car row, the same as the 12. And then...
Reconnaissance and...
Yes, and reconnaissance was force, etc. And also being able to fight for one's reconnaissance. It was exactly the same role as... and we were the armoured car regiment to the London Division, Territorial Division. And then, of course, just the outbreak of war, our tanks were taken away. Our armoured cars were taken away. We were given tanks.
Just before you come on to that, if I stay at this pre-war period, you work with regular soldiers, regular units at any stage?
Yes, we had an exercise against, our regimental exercise was against the 12th, but that was because I was adjutant of the 12th, and they always tried to help. The regular regiment adjutant was always tried to help the particular territorial regiment. And in fact, the when we were made the two regiments, the 4th County London Regiment, the new regiment was commanded by Bill Carr, who was my squadron leader, who took over command and then became a brigadier, a brilliant soldier. He commanded the 4th County London Regiment, and I went to action originally with him, with the 4th County London Regiment.
How did this exercise go on that you were working against the regulars? How did the territorials do?
Oh, I think they did very well. I mean, you know, they didn't altogether win, but they put up a pretty good show.
What were they actually going to have to do? What was sort of...
It was probably trying to find the enemy and pinpoint the enemy and get round their flanks and all that sort of business. I can't remember the exercise offhand. It's nearly 40 years ago.
During the day-to-day routine, how often did these men come to train and things?
Twice a week. Not all of them, of course. But they had to do 70 drills a year. And they came to the drill halls in John's Wood. They were all Londoners.
What sort of men were they?
Mostly clerks out of offices and things like that. A large percent of potential officers, war officers, short service, you know, and a large percentage of them, I think 30% in both regiments, or 20% in both regiments, became officers during the war. They were mostly of that class. I mean, they were mostly highly intelligent. But what happened at the outbreak of war, all the reservists of the 11th and 12th went back to 12th, and there were far too many, and they took all their 12th. And I had a lot of 11th Hussar ones, a few 12th reservists come to the 3rd and 4th County of London Regiment, ex-regular reserve chaps, to boost them up. And he worked factory well. But I remember the regimental sergeant major complaining about the sergeant's mess. "Very awkward, sir," he said. "You see, sergeant's mess I'm used to dealing with. I've got some of these old sergeants, Gilbert, Clydesdale, one or two others, and I got about half of them like that. And the other half are public schoolboys. And when you look at Sergeant McCall, you find that Sergeant McCall's wife is a great friend of Lady Onslow's, who's your second in command. And with extra, Sergeant McCall was educated in Rugby and commanded the regiment just after the war. Or just at the end of the war, no, just after the war, I think, anyway. But, I mean, that was the sort of... he's a wonderful man, and he said, for God's sake, let's have a... At one period, they wanted to dance while in the train, and he said, that wouldn't work. But he ran it frightfully well, and he ran it as a... I said, how'd you run it, Mr. Fuller? Partly as a sergeant's mess, and partly as an officer's mess, and it works. But, and it worked, too. He was a wonderful man.
Why do you think those men were coming to become trained like that? What was the sort of reason?
Well, they all came, and then there was this... I had the most terrible time just before the war. The telephone never, never stopped. People trying to enlist. And, of course, when the 4th were there, we were able to pick and choose who should be officers and who should be sergeants. And then we were full up. And I used to say, well, if you can get anywhere else... I've got room for you as a trooper. And then they flocked. And so one had a sort of tremendous cross-section. But, I mean, as I say, I think we were something like 20% of the other ranks, 15% were public schoolboys. And I should have thought we were 80% grammar school, very intelligent chaps. But they were very high-class... men.
The equipment you were using, was it permanently with you, the armoured cars?
We had three, I think. And then in camp, you were given a whole lot more. We had enough for, we had four, I think, enough for troop and one spare. And then, you see, weekends, one often the troop would go out to go out and exercise on its own with an officer. Occasionally, when one thought one had a sergeant who was safe enough, you did, until I got Tom Matthews, who knocked down Amersham Town Hall. Oh, my God. He became an officer. In fact, he commanded a squadron in the war, but he knocked down Amersham Town, or half did, and they were the most frightful rounds. After that, I was only allowed to send an officer. But a splendid old gentleman called Colonel Jago commanded, who was in the South Irish Horse in the First World War. And he's a remarkable character.
On the evening work that you did instruction in maintenance and things, did you?
Yeah, well, all instruction. They did, in the summer, they did a certain amount of driving, which must have been highly dangerous. I never did it in London, in St. John's Wood. But it was, yes, it was all what I call individual training. Wireless, gunnery, and driving and maintenance.
What was the actual armoured car you were working on?
Rails.
When, what happened when you transferred to tanks then? How quickly did that happen when the war broke out?
I'm afraid you got me there. Did it happen, did it happen just before the war or just after? Within, I think probably just before, I can't remember. And we got these Mark III little, like, awful little tanks. And we went, we mobilised at St. John's Wood, and then we moved to Minehead. We went there along, and then we moved up to Derbyshire. And then Derbyshire, I went from, gave up Edge and went as a squadron leader of the 4th County London Army. We were in the same brigade. And then we went to Lincolnshire. And then we went to Salisbury Plain before we went abroad in, for 41. We went abroad, we sailed in June 41, I think. And then I was with them in the desert for 9 months as second in command and commanding. And then I went to the KDGs to command them for 3 weeks and got wounded. And then, meanwhile, the 12th commanding officer had been captured, so I went to them. So I had both tanks and armoured cars in the desert.
Did the training, do you think, that those yeomanry people had had with you serve a good purpose during the war?
Oh, I think so, but of course it... I mean, it took time to knock them into soldiers. I mean... the yeomanry of those days would have taken at least 6 months training or before they were any use. Yeah, I mean, we had over a year's training, and that was pretty good. They were pretty... But we hadn't got the practical training that they... But we had this... nucleus of regular NCOs. They were damn good, very, very good fighting. But possibly the 4th were brilliantly technically handled by Brigadier Carr. But I think it could have been... They couldn't have been better trained, but it was very difficult from the point of view of training. I've got one or two odd notes, which I think of a great deal of importance attached, which happened during the war, which probably nobody knows about. And I think it was probably 1942, maybe 43, we got our first Daimler armoured cars. The 11th Hussars got there. And we were sent, only given 4 days to convert, pulled out of action, to convert to a vehicle we didn't know. But anyway, that didn't matter. We knew the role. But I sent them out on the third day for a tactical exercise. And to my horror, the complete wireless broke down. And I investigated. And we'd had terrible trouble. And I think that this mustn't be mentioned. I might be sued for libel over this, so watch out. We had Ferranti condensers, and we'd proved that the particular type of Ferranti condensers were US. And they just broke down. And let us... And Monty had ordered an edict that no more Ferranti condensers should be issued. So I was, at the time, Army Armoured Car Regiment. And I rang him up personally. I was about 40. And I said, look here, I said, this, you want me into action the day after tomorrow. And my wireless is US. He said, I said, I've got phoretic intensity. He said, what? I said, never again. I said, well, now don't blame your signals. These new armored cars have come out. And this hasn't come through the signal channel. It's going through the armored unit. And they know nothing about it. And I said, I've checked with the 11th, and they're breaking down. He said, and how long do you want after I get the phoretic condensers? I said, I'll be ready in 36 hours. Well, you do realize that I've got to put in the whole of my attack for 24 hours. I said, I'm sorry, sir, but I'm not in operation in the 11th hour. Very good. He said, then I'll tell you what to do in 12 minutes. And then he rang up an hour later. And he said, you'll send your signal officer with 2 3-ton trucks, the aerodrome, forward aerodrome, and the Ferranti condensers will land from England with the Wellington tomorrow morning. 11th of the will do the same thing. And then you've got 28 hours to get them going and get in your position for the attack. But now that's an interesting one. And they came, and they were there dead on time. They were flown out that night by Wellington from England. But the two regiments, his two armoured car regiments, which he was going to do the attack with, US, the wireless had gone. But I mean, that's an interesting point.
What was the trouble with the wires that had done this?
I can't remember. It was a Ferranti condenser. The condenser went. Mm. Absolutely used. And I don't know whether. Anyway, we never got them again after that. But it just shows you that the whole attack, for one little thing, that I thought might be of interest. Code, I've told you about the codes, haven't I? We get our own special codes. An interesting thing. Would it interest you to hear about pattern? Well, the setup of meeting when we joined up with the Americans. Monty said to me, now you're on the outside left. I want to know immediately. I was army troops. I was directly under his command. I want to know immediately when we meet the Americans. And we should do in the next 2 or 3 days. So I put up two like troop leaders, and then I put up a very nice boy who's still alive called John Richardson on the flank, the third day, not the first two. And I had the director, and he said, well, I've seen our friends. I can see it now. But they won't come anywhere near us. And when we approach them, they retired. I can't get in touch. And he said, oh, I see a jeep coming towards me. So I thought, that's all right. And then he said, they're here now. He said, I got an extraordinary fan. I said, it's a pistol-packing mama has just got out. And I said, what's he? I never met an American. I didn't know. He said, he got 2 stars in his hat. I said, well, be very careful. That's their sun ray, which was meant their boss. This was Geordie Patton. And he said, well, say, my fellows don't seem to want to come and meet you, so I thought I'd come myself. General! And that was the first meeting up with the Americans. Another thing about Monty, which I thought was a very good show, was I'd been wounded, and my second in command was commanding, and we had this breakthrough before Tunis. And we got the orders, and I arrived back the day, 2 days before that day, and we got 48 hours. Gave me the orders, and not a bit of it. At 1 o'clock, I got a message saying that Monty was coming down, 45 miles to see me. And he came all the way, and he said, George, I've given the orders for second in command, but I thought you'd like to know exactly what I'm planning. Just gave me the thing right off the handle like that. He's quite brilliant. And then you've read about this Ultima thing, have you? Well, we could never understand. I can remember it well, a thing we call the Rock of Gibraltar at Menin. We went up. He asked me to go up to show him the panorama because we were the armored car regiment in front. And Oliver Leese was coming up, who was the corps commander. And I sort of went on. We got very little space, not very much bigger than this room twice, because it was still mine, where they'd mine. We sat up, and he gave us lunch. He brought
who was that? Monty.
He gave us picnic lunch. So I moved on. No, no, come on. Listen to what I give my orders. So he gave the whole orders to Oliver Leese of the Maris battle, of how. He said, now, Rommel is going to attack. This was about the 16th of February. He's going to attack me between March the 3rd and March the 5th.
What year would this be?
43, I think. When did the campaign end? 43, yes. March 43. This was February. He's going to attack between March the 2nd and March the 5th. And he's going to do this. And now you get to set up. I'm not going into that detail. And he said, you won't be there, but one of your squadrons, you must come up and have a look at the battle. And I went up. I got one squadron, which was told exactly. And the thing happened exactly as Monty had predicted 3 weeks before. Well, of course, he got the information from Altamar. And we never understood this, but it was the most brilliant action. And, of course, he got the thing battle absolutely taped.
You would say he accepted this information and was...
Yes, he didn't always. The trouble was he didn't accept it at Arnhem. There were reasons why he didn't accept it. But... And also he got it on the when we were attacked at El Alamein, must have done, from the forecast. And of course he made soldiering easier, because he told us what the enemy were going to do and what we had to do. And we got complete confidence in him. I don't say everybody liked him. I got a tremendous admiration for him. I didn't like the way he treated General Lumsden, but we always got on very well otherwise. But that was that. Yes, the two-pounder and the tanks, I think I've told you. I told you about that at lunch. The two-pounder and the tanks was, when we were in the tanks, was absolutely ridiculous, because it could only penetrate the Germans sideways off. Neither of you shot them at the back or the front. It just ricocheted off. And it wasn't a great morale booster. And as I say, I told you, these people at Cobham, all they thought about was accuracy. I know it was dead accurate. But we were bleated and bleated for a bigger gun. And nobody seemed to pay any attention. And we felt very, very strongly about that. It was quite ridiculous. At that period, if we'd had a 6-pound gun, we'd be on...